Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I'm your host for the weekend show, also your host throughout the week at our website, kereport.com, and on our podcast, Corlin Economics Report. I commentate and, well, update everybody on market moves as well as company updates, and it was another busy week, especially on the company update front. Please, everybody, keep those emails coming, fleck@kereport.com. I'm kicking off this weekend show with a new guest to the actual weekend show. His name is Steve Penny. He is the publisher of The Silver Chartist. I've had Steve on for the last about month now, and I'm very impressed with his outlook on the markets, especially precious metals, balancing a lot of technicals with some of the fundamentals, as well as what he shares with his subscribers, some of the stocks that he is trading into and out of. We're going to get into the stocks a little bit later, but let's start off with the general precious metals here and gold. Steve, you and I were chatting off mic, and you were outlining to me this more or less triangle pattern that is forming in gold that really looks like it's coming to a point in the near term. So that means a decision needs to be made for gold, whether it's going to have a leg higher or maybe have another leg lower. Break down this triangle pattern that you are following closely here, please, Steve.
Yeah, you bet, Corey. And thanks again for inviting me on. It's always great to come on and visit with you and speak to your audience. But yeah, a lot of us have been so zeroed in on this 7-month downtrend channel, which is really pretty obvious, dating back to August of 2020. And I recently noticed this uptrend line that dates all the way back to May of 2019. And that trend line was tapped last year in March of 2020 during those lows. Then we came back in the early part of this month and tapped that trend line again. And then if you draw a downtrend from the recent high in January, we've got a triangle pattern, a symmetrical triangle pattern that's forming right now. We're approaching the apex of that triangle, and that typically precedes a fairly sharp move in one direction or the other. Now, patterns like this tend to break in the direction of the prevailing trend. But what makes this especially hard to perhaps decipher is that you can make a case that we're in a downtrend or an uptrend here, depending on your time frame. So this really could go either way. I've got a slight bias to the upside, but to come back down and retest the recent lows would not surprise me at all either.
Now, when does this triangle formation actually come to an end? Because usually we get a break a little bit before that, but what I'm seeing on the chart is it's actually quite soon.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we could get a break at any point, but the apex will be reached that first week of April.
What are you expecting then, Steve? Or what are you going to be watching to give you a little heads up as to which way gold might move?
Well, right now I'm looking at it. It's hugging the upper rail of that triangle pattern, and it's threatening to break out. In fact, a couple days this week, it's poked its head above it and then fallen back down. So if we get a break above, there's your confirmation. And of course, you would look for a weekly and then a monthly close above that resistance line, and that would give you confirmation. But you know, another thing everyone's been talking about, and rightfully so, is the cup and handle pattern on gold when you zoom out to the 10 or 11 year monthly chart. And it does look like we're starting to carve out a handle to go along with that cup. And, you know, I've been thinking about this lately. You know, when are we going to get back to new highs? That's what everyone wants to know, right? Or when are we going to get to this $2,400, $2,500 plus gold? And, you know, it's certainly possible that we really get there sooner than anyone thinks. However, I think the most likely scenario would be to carve out a symmetrical handle. So what I mean by that is it's taken 7 months for us to carve out this downtrend. Now, what I would look for is for us to kind of chop sideways here for maybe a couple weeks. And then if we were to bottom to get a symmetrical handle pattern, it would take another 7 months to match the 7 months downtrend. And that would put us up near new highs towards the very end of this year. And I think that's a good baseline. I don't even want to say assumption, but that's something to look for.
Okay. So do you think that's going to happen? Because you're right. That's what everyone's wondering. When is gold going to get back to those new highs? And I know some of the newer investors into the sector is saying, is this actually a top that we just saw? And are we ever going to get back to new highs?
Yeah, I mean, that's my baseline assumption. But, you know, as a technical analyst, you always react to new information as it comes in. But yeah, that's basically what I'm looking to happen over the remainder of this year.
So you do think that new all-time highs could be reached by the end of the year, but the most important thing right now is forming a bottom, correct? Having gold actually have a bottom here and start to build on the price, actually move higher finally.
Exactly. Yeah, we're sitting just above this very strong area of support between 1690 and 1715. That's reinforced by Fibonacci support and also the lower boundary of this downtrend channel we've been talking about for 8 months. So there's really strong support just below current prices. I continue to expect that support to hold. And I would look for a bottom to carve out over the next few weeks and then hopefully resume this uptrend here within the next probably 4 to 6 weeks, let's call it.
Let's talk about silver now, Steve, because silver has been a bit more volatile than gold, which is normal for silver. But one of the aspects that the gold bugs have been holding on to is that silver had been performing better than gold. You look at its last 7 months and it's traded very much in a range, not in a downtrend like gold had. However, recently we have seen a little bit more weakness come into silver. Really looks like silver's trading more off its industrial uses, almost more in line with some of the base metals. How are you viewing silver and some of this short-term weakness that we've seen?
Yeah, I agree 100%. Silver has held up much better than gold. In fact, over the past 7 months, silver has outperformed gold by almost a factor of two. That gold-to-silver ratio was up near 123 in March of last year. And it got down to a low of about 65. So it's almost outperformed by a factor of two. And, you know, I think the industrial element is a big part of it. But there's also, I mean, you can almost say record, all-time record demand for investment demand. We're seeing shortages right now at mints around the world. So I think that's a big part of it. The world is waking up to investment as a attractive option for investing. And what I'm looking at on the chart here is the 200-day moving average. We're sitting just above that. And then we're sitting just above the low that was marked in the early part of March of $24.84. So I'm looking and hoping, to be honest, for those two support levels to hold.
Let's also talk about the gold-silver ratio. It's not something I've talked about too much recently, but there has been a drastic change in the way gold and silver have reacted during this last, let's say, year of trading. The gold-silver ratio right now is under 70, when for most of last year it was above, let's say, 80, even spiked up during that March washout to 127. That's an extreme level, but you can also make the argument that being below 70 is actually a fairly low level. So gold is maybe underpriced compared to silver.
Yeah, you can make that case. So I'm looking right now at a gold-silver ratio chart going back to 1980, so just over 40 years, and it's actually just in the middle right now of this 40-year range. And back in 2011, we bottomed at 33-1. And anytime you get below 45-1, those tend to be short-lived. A lot of people talk about the 15-1 gold-silver ratio that was reached in 1980. While I do expect that to be reached again in the fullness of time, you know, that's very likely to be some kind of a spike. So personally, once we get below a ratio of roughly 50-1, I start looking more towards gold-related investments as opposed to silver. But I think silver's got some, I do expect silver to outperform gold over the intermediate term here to long term.
Do you find that viewing at least some of these moves over the last year, especially when you pull up something like a monthly chart for this gold-silver ratio, it's been an absolute mess in all fairness over the last year. We have massive gaps. The price for both of these metals has been all over the place. So do we just need a bit more of a settle down in terms of this crazy volatility we've had?
Yeah. And like I said, silver has outperformed gold. Its outperformance has been really fast. So looking at the chart, you know, it's on that ratio is oversold. So I would look for a little bit of a reversion in that ratio, and that can happen one of three ways. And I'm talking about in the short term here. Like I said, longer term, I'm more bullish on silver. However, over the short term, we can look for gold to outperform, and that can happen one of three ways. Silver can continue to chop sideways, and gold kind of catches up a little bit. Both metals can move higher. It just gold might move higher faster in the short term. Yeah, and then the third way, which I don't expect, would be that both metals fall. It's just that silver would fall more. So that's one of three ways that that gold-silver ratio could kind of alleviate that oversold condition on the RSI.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, let's also talk about the way you manage your portfolio. More balance between producers the whole way down to juniors, because you do cover a wide range of these stocks, some producers, some down into the juniors. And the way that you structure your portfolio really has some thought put into it, rather than simply following, let's say, an interesting story or a hot market or a hot stock here. You are focused on how your portfolio is balanced. Can you share how you view the balance between majors, minors, and the exploration companies?
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a great question, especially for a lot of new entrants to the sector. You know, a lot of people focus almost exclusively on stock selection. Now, obviously, that's very important to choose high quality stocks. However, you know, I like to start with asking yourself how you want to structure this portfolio amongst your top tiers, your mid tiers, and then your highly speculative stocks. So personally, I do about 30% in the top tier, 50% in the mid tier producers, and then about 20% for those higher risk speculations, the explorers and developers. And then once I have that framework, then I can go look into jurisdictional diversification. You know, it's, especially as a silver investor, it's easy to get overly concentrated in Mexico. Now, there's nothing wrong with Mexico. It's just I don't want all my eggs in that basket. So these are the kind of questions I ask myself before I even start looking at individual stocks. Once I have that structure in place, then I can go look at the stocks that fit those that criteria.
Now, what about actively trading and taking long positions? I understand, again, by reading through your newsletter that you do hold a balance there, but you are a bit more focused on longer term positions.
Exactly. Yeah. History suggests that it's very hard to outperform a simple buy and hold strategy in a bull market. So that's what I do personally with 90% of my portfolio. It just sits in a buy and hold strategy. And I've got a personalized long-term exit strategy that's based on ratios. And that's where I'll begin to scale out. And I think we're a long ways away from that. Now with 10%, I personally do short-term trading. And what's nice about that is, you know, whenever I trade, I use stop losses. So in the event we get some kind of panic-driven sell-off or liquidity event, you know, that trading account automatically turns to cash as those stops are triggered. And then you've got cash available to scoop up bargains. So that's my personal strategy.
Are you seeing a sweet spot right now in terms of gold stocks, silver stocks, producers, royalty companies, exploration companies? I'm opening the book up to you. Do you see any opportunities that are just screaming at you right now?
Yeah, when we visited 2 weeks ago, it was the top tier gold mining companies and top tier royalty and streaming companies that were really presenting the best value proposition. And we have seen them perform the best over the past few weeks. But I do still think they are the most, they're presenting the most compelling entry points from a long-term perspective right now.
Hey, Steve, we're going to wrap it up here. I really appreciate you spending the last few segments with us in terms of daily editorials, and that's one of the reasons why I did want to feature you on the weekend show. If anybody wants more information on Steve's Silver Chartist, please email me, fleck@kereport.com. I'll put you in touch with Steve. Hey, Steve, it's great chatting with you. I look forward to having you back on the show in a couple weeks. Thank you again for joining us on this weekend show. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You too. Thank you so much.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm going to stick to more resource investing, but in a broad sense. I'm chatting now with Brian Lenny, founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review website and the Premium Newsletter. Brian, you and I were chatting off mic here for quite a while, talking about looking at share structure and looking at advisors to companies. We hear a lot about companies promoting the fact that they have these strategic investors or large institutions, usually bigger companies that hold a somewhat significant portion of shares. Sometimes it's only 5%, sometimes it's up to 19% of the company. But one thing we need to understand is that not all strategic investors are the same. There's a number of different aspects to analyze when it comes to A, how these strategic investors built their position, and B, I think even more importantly, how active they are with this smaller company, Brian, let's start off there. When you're looking at strategic investors and you're diving into the company, when it comes to how closely they're related and how they're working together, what are some of the keys that you look for?
Thanks for having me, Corey. So for me, you know, it always depends. It depends on what type of company it is. So, let's say it's exploration, and you want to gauge the impact of strategic a shareholder, whether that be an institution, maybe a singular investor, maybe like an Eric Sprott, or let's say another, like a senior mining company or another mining company that's taken an interest. For me, I think there's a number of questions you want to look at. You know, how recent is this strategic position taken? Is it in the financing that's really recent? You know, they've taken, you know, 10% of the company, or was this something that they acquired through, you know, an option deal 2 years ago, or was this shares that they bought in a private placement 2 or 3 years ago? And if they did, have they maintained their percentage? Have they maintained 10%, meaning any private placement that's happened since then, they've put in enough to maintain their percentage and not get diluted down. I think that's one of the things that you want to take a look at and give you some relevance on how that company views the potential in that junior that they've taken a position in. From more so on a strategic side, you know, you can see you know, the singular investors. I will use an example for this that I have no connection to the company at all, but I did meetings with them. There's a company called Northern Superior, and Michael Gentile is a strategic shareholder there, and he actually participated in the meetings at this PDAC one-on-one conference. And I thought that was pretty interesting. You know, obviously this guy not only owns 16% of the company, but he's participating in the one-on-one meetings, meaning that he does have a lot of you know, he's putting his money where his mouth is in his position, but he's also working on the day-to-day operations with the company and using his network connections and what he knows about investing to help promote the company. So I think that was, to me, that was a really good sign on that company. Now, I'm not invested in Northern Superior, but I like to see that strategic shareholder actually meant something. And you can parlay that into companies too. You know, are they involved in a technical advisory committee? Does that technical advisory committee cost anything to the company? Or is it just there to make decisions on where the company's doing their generative work? You know, how they're going to focus targeting for a drill program and such. And so I think those are a couple of the ways that you can kind of gauge the impact of a strategic shareholder.
All of those are good examples, and touching on your initial point there, how they built their position. That's also critical, because sometimes these shareholders or institutions that are being marketed built their position through either offloading a project or, in essence, not actually paying for their position through financings and maintaining their position. That's the key to consider. When you're looking at these strategic investors, though, Brian, are you wanting to see them as simply investors or possible acquirers? Very different take there.
You know, it depends on who it is. And I think it depends on their track record too. You know, there's some guys, let's use Eric Sprott. You know, I think it's a really good example because people get really hot and heavy when they see Eric Sprott's name as a strategic shareholder, which I think, you know, partially is something that, you know, that means something. But on the other side, he's in so many different companies that, you know, he spreads his money around so that he can hit those winners. And, you know, his strategy doesn't necessarily fit the general retail investor. So you have to be very careful with using a guy like Eric Sprott as a gauge to if you should go into a company or not. And then some of these other guys, you know, you do have to gauge their track record. And I'll use a couple of examples that I used in my recent newsletter when I was talking about this. In terms of senior mining companies, someone like Kinross, you know, their track record, in my view, hasn't been that great in terms of joint ventures that they've done. And I've seen more failures than successes. And so if Kinross is the major company that's taken the joint venture with a junior that I'm looking at, I'm a little more skeptical on possibly how that company views the joint venture deal and if I should put any weighting towards it. Now, that's just my view. People can view that differently. But I think that's part of the thing you need to do is look at that that whoever that strategic investor is and look at their track record and then parlay that into what that could actually mean to the company. And, you know, for senior mining companies, I like to see them take a technical role. For, you know, large investors, obviously, they're there to participate with their money. And that's like Eric Sprott. It looks like a guy like Michael Gentile does more than just contribute his money. It looks like he's right involved with the companies. And I think that's good too. But again, it always depends on who that strategic is and what they bring to the table as a strategic investor.
Let's also talk about joint ventures, because this ties into this conversation. And joint ventures, they can come in many different forms, usually in a staged payment form. So I really think you do need to pay attention to how those payments are staged, but also when it comes to who's running the actual exploration program. Do you have a preference when you see a major teamed up with a junior? Does it depend to you who runs that actual exploration program?
Yeah. Again, it's another one of those, it depends. I'll use an example, Kenorland. They're the operator for their joint venture with Sumitomo. I'm very comfortable. In fact, I like that they are the operator on Renault, and I'm hyper confident in them as a management team and their ability to execute on an exploration program. Now, if the team was different, you know, if technical expertise or acumen wasn't their strength, which I think in Kenorland's position it is, I would rather the senior mining company be the operator and the one that's, you know, doing everything when it comes to, you know, executing on the exploration program. So again, it's one of those things that it's a case by case basis. And then obviously I think people should always be playing to their skill set. And if technical is your skill set, then I think you should be driving the bus. The other side to that is, you know, some of the major mining companies just don't go for that, and they'll only contribute their money if they can choose where it is spent. And, you know, in some cases, that's fine. You know, if you want to de-risk your project and take on less risk as an explorer, then these are some of the things that you have to do to do that. But, you know, in some cases, that's going to work out for you. In some cases, it's not. And people need to look at, for example, a senior mining company that takes a joint venture project and exploration. And I think most of these major mining companies are looking for these elephants, right? They're looking for big targets, you know, plus 5 million ounce deposits. They go execute an exploration program that's, you know, isolating things to only show if there's a 5 million ounce deposit. And if there isn't, they're not interested. So, you know, these guys can release joint ventures and, you know, they get a negative stigma because, you know, oh, the senior mining company left. But, you know, I think most of these junior companies, if it was, you know, over a 1 million ounce deposit, that still has a lot of value in most cases. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that the project is bad. But again, it depends. It always depends.
It does always depend. And you know what? It usually is a good sign to see a major in there, but you really need to analyze how active that major is and how that project is moving forward. Because sometimes when these majors do pull out or these strategic investors pull out, you always see a drop in the share price, but that can usually offer some sort of an opportunity for investors. Brian, overall then, would you say it's usually a positive to have these strategic investors in there, but it really comes down to digging into the story as to how they got involved and what those major strategies are, the strategic strategies are, to understand just how, I guess, profitable that investment could be?
Yeah, 100%. I think generally speaking, a good strategic investor is always good to the story. But it always requires the investor to do the due diligence to understand, you know, everything about that. Like all those points that we covered, you know, at what price did they get in? Are they maintained their interest? How are they maintaining their interest? Are they actively involved technically, or are they just providing money? You know, having a good, clear idea of how that relationship works and how it works into your investment thesis is key. But generally speaking, yes, 100%. Good strategic investors are pluses to junior mining company.
All right, Brian, we're wrapping it up there. Great chatting with you. Very interesting discussion. I hope this cleared up some of, well, for all you investors out there, at least makes you focus a little bit more on some of these strategic investors and not just take the company's word from it saying, oh, they're a strategic investor and that's a good thing. Make sure you check how active they are in the actual program that is being run. Brian, great chatting with you on this weekend show. I'll chat with you again next week. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks for having me, Corey.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Those first two segments, I did spend a bit more time on the resource sector. So in the final two segments, I'm going to shift focus a little bit more and talk broad markets. It's something I've been talking a lot about this week simply because, well, precious metals, they're in a downtrend, continuing in that downtrend. But the broad markets are also very interesting. I am chatting right now with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago. Dana, one of the, I guess, biggest changes over the last couple of weeks when it comes to the broad averages is we are seeing a bit more choppiness. We have the S&P a little bit off of its highs. The NASDAQ is still a fair bit off of its highs when you compare it to some of the other markets. Russell 2000, the small caps, those are still doing quite well. But it's not this, I guess, kind of boring market that just continues to trend higher, like we had seen really ever since the election. How does this impact the way that you're managing your portfolios in this market?
Right. I think that's a fair assessment, Corey, because as you mentioned, after the election, you had pretty much a sweet spot of in terms of market action, market conditions. And we called it, you know, as we talked several times, probably the best trading environment that I've seen in my career, many, many decades. So if that was easy money, you know, the 3 months after the election, as we talked about maybe starting a month ago or so, we're in a period where it's the money's going to be a little bit harder to come by. So it doesn't mean, as we've spoken about, that we see any indications of a major top, the risk of a major top or the risk of a major bear market starting anytime soon. But like I said, the easy money is over. And I think over the last, you know, 4 to 6 weeks has been evidence of that. So as far as our handling of that type of environment, we call it a two-way environment, so it's not just straight up. Our tactics have been a little bit more active, not just buying the dips, but also selling the rips into resistance, even putting on hedges into resistance as well. And also on the downside, not buying the slightest of dips, you know, but being a little bit more patient in considering that prices might certainly move down to more substantial lower support levels before, and it might be more prudent, more wise to be patient and waiting for those lower prices at this point. So we've been a little bit more active in the range and what we've been buying and where we've been buying it. And probably had more hedges on recently than we have in quite some time.
So you're putting on hedges, but you're not necessarily cleaning out any of your long positions. Does that mean, or if you could summarize your, I guess, general outlook, are you bearish? Are you bullish? Are you more neutral?
In the short term, neutral. Our risk model, which is an intermediate term risk model, is in a bearish position, has been since shifting south about 3 weeks ago. But our read of that signal right now, like I said, is not, it's not likely to be indicative of a major top or a major bear market, impending bear market here. More or less, probably, you know, many of the components within our model got extremely overbought, extremely extended, and it's more or less just gravity pulling it down a little bit. It's what we talk about sometimes as a good overbought reading. It's just a sign of kind of like a thrust in terms of whether it's breath or you're talking about momentum. It's a good initial thrust higher. But that has to be worked off, reset for some time before you can refuel and set yourself up for another leg up. So I think that's what we're doing right now in this two-way market, kind of refueling, resetting some of the sentiment levels that got pretty excessive and putting the market back into a position eventually where we think we see more new highs in the intermediate term.
So it is kind of that general, I guess, sentiment, more or less correction that you're waiting for, not necessarily price, where price can move sideways in a choppy nature, and sentiment and some of the technical indicators that were at overbought levels have their time to work back to some more normal levels to set up for another run higher. Let's also talk about the VIX, too, because the volatility that we have seen in the market, when you look at the VIX has been relatively boring. It's right around that 20 level. In all fairness, it's not nearly as low as it was 2, 3, 4 years ago when it was dropping into single digits. But the VIX has also been showing that, I guess, traders aren't that worried about a major market pullback right now. However, the VIX, again, is at generally higher levels than it was a couple years ago. So how are you viewing the VIX in this market perception?
Yeah, so volatility has been extremely subdued, like you said. Sometimes, like I mentioned before, sometimes when you get a spike up, it could be a good buy signal. When you get a rush of fear into the market, it could be a nice short-term, more clear buy signal. We haven't gotten that, so we haven't seen, in terms of the volatility indices, a good all clear sign in terms of a buy signal there. But we've seen in other areas, we've seen signs of complacency coming off and some of the bullish sentiment starting to subside a little bit. So I think actually the VIX, the volatility indices, not just on the S&P, but the Russell as well as the NASDAQ 100, the fact that it's remained subdued is actually fairly bullish sign for us in the sense that it's maintained this level basically over the last 12 months, and it has it keeps pounding against those support levels in the VIX around that 20 level. I think it's got a chance, and this could be a real bullish catalyst for stocks eventually here, at least for a while, if we can break down decisively below those that 20 level and below those lows on those other volatility indices. I think it could be a bullish catalyst for stocks and actually a nice little tailwind for stocks. So complacency certainly got too high and certainly can come down a little bit more, but I think the volatility indices remaining low isn't necessarily a warning sign at this point.
Let's also talk about the US dollar, because the US dollar, I feel like under the radar, has been rising this whole year. It bottomed pretty much at the very beginning of this year at 89.17, and as we're recording this later in the day on Thursday, making a run higher, trading just under that 93 level. So that's a fairly big move for a currency, especially the US dollar. However, we do need to consider that back in late March of last year, it was 103 on the dollar index. So a lot of volatility in the dollar. What's your assessment of this dollar's rebound? Has it put in a bottom, or is this just more or less a bounce in a downtrend?
Yeah, in our assessment so far, there's nothing to prove that, you know, we're shifting out of the downtrend that it's been in for, you know, over a year now, like you mentioned. There might be rounding out and entering some sort of a trading range, or maybe it is putting in, you know, a basing pattern to reverse higher. In our view, the pace of advance has not been such that it's convincing to us that we're moving back higher. So until proven otherwise, we are selling the dollar into rallies of resistance. We actually just shorted it yesterday. A decisive move up here, a decisive close up here towards that 93 level would probably prove us wrong here in the near term. And we probably wouldn't wait around for that, for a reversal there. But that said, if we do get a swift reversal back below, say, that 92.60-ish level, 92.75 level, we could have a false breakout here and set the stage for the next leg lower in the dollar. So I think basically the long story short is the benefit of the doubt is still to the downside in the intermediate term in the dollar until proven otherwise. And it very well might prove us otherwise. But for now, you know, we're selling the rips and looking for continued lower prices in the dollar. Again, with the caveat that a decisive close where we're trading right now might be enough to at least stop us out of that dollar short and reassess maybe the potential for at least further upside in the dollar in the short term.
Okay. Has this dollar's bounce at least recently put pressure on commodities, do you think? Has that been one of the biggest impact on this downtrend that we've seen, or at least this correction in base metals, commodities broadly?
As you know, we don't like to assess reasons for market moves generally, but I think it's reasonable to assume that much of the move lower recently, much of the softness in across the commodity space, as well as some of the resource-laden equities and foreign markets, might very well be attributed to, you know, the strengthening of the dollar, which again makes this juncture perhaps a key juncture for not only the dollar and other commodities, but you know, other anti-dollar assets and in the commodity space, in obviously other currencies, and even in some of the equity land. So it's a development we're watching pretty closely here in the short term, and could be either a bullish or a bearish catalyst depending on which way the dollar goes here.
What are some of the key levels to watch for the dollar on the upside here if it does keep trending higher?
If we decisively break above, like, say, this 92.75 level, then we're looking up, you know, around 94.5 to 95 would be our next spot. So not material higher, but certainly opens up in the near term further upside, which could continue to, you know, put pressure on those other assets that we talked about.
All right, let's wrap this up by talking about oil, because oil has been going through a fairly significant correction. Oil has been really on a tear for the last, well, in that low in November at 33.64, it ran, really doubled at up to the recent peak in early March of almost $68. But from that level, it's pulled back a fair bit. As we're recording this, it's under $60 a barrel, trading around 58.45. So a fairly significant pullback, but there is some support right around this level. What's your outlook for the oil market?
Yeah, we've been, you know, buying the dips. There haven't been many dips in oil, but in the near term, we've been buying the dips in oil, and especially in the energy stock. So that's been one of the more consistent plays, especially since the election time, is buying every little dip in the energy stocks, whether it's energy services or the producers, whatever. It's been a good trade, and some of those areas are under pressure right now, and testing really a key level here, especially in even in crude itself, the commodity itself, I think is testing a key spot right here. If we do break down from here, I think it opens up at least another 10% of downside, if not more. So it's a key spot here. Like I said, with the dollar, we got a key spot here in crude oil as well. So a key juncture perhaps in the short term across many of the financial markets, which makes it an interesting spot right here.
Yeah, it does. Overall, though, you don't really have a focus on any sector within the oil sector. Hey, it sounds like you're just playing it broadly.
Well, we play ETF, so we don't do individual stocks at all for our clients. So we've been playing the oil services via OIH, equipment and services via the XES ETF. ETF, which has been spectacular, as well as, you know, the broad XLE, which we are still long. So we're still long all those. We've been buying the dips, a couple of them under a little bit of pressure right now. So we'd like to see them hold these areas and set up the potential for another up leg, which certainly if crude oil holds in this area, certainly would be a big help toward producing that next upleg for energy stocks.
Perfect, Dana. Nice chatting with you, buddy. I appreciate that general assessment of the markets, the dollar, and crude. I'll be chatting with you again in another couple weeks, but we definitely have seen a bit more volatility creep into these markets. But again, you're still not taking that more bearish outlook. Dana, thanks for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, Corey. Always a pleasure.
Alright, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are going to continue to focus a bit more broadly on these markets and focus more on the currency markets as I am chatting with Mark Chandler. He is a managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also writes the Mark to Market blog. Now, Mark, when it comes to the U.S. dollar, I really feel like under the radar, the dollar has been moving up all year. No one is paying that much attention to it. And fair enough. You know, the dollar is still not at these like astronomical levels that we can say it was a year ago, well over 100 on the dollar index. But to start this year, the dollar right around 89, and now it's challenging that 93 level. You and I were chatting off mic, and the extent of these dollar moves against a wide range of currencies definitely needs to be noted. Can you break down some of the outperformance that we've seen in the dollar compared to other currencies, please?
Sure. So maybe the place to begin is just thinking about what's happened this past week. The dollar has made new highs for the year, first quarter, against the euro, the yen, so those are the two big currencies, Swiss franc, Swedish krona, the Aussie, Kiwi, but also made new highs for the year against the Chinese currency. So this is really the major currencies right here, leaving aside the Canadian dollar and the British pound. So I'd say that I'd say you're right. The dollar has it hasn't gotten a lot of fanfare, a lot of attention. Maybe that's been taken up by the equity markets, but the dollar has really it's really defied a lot of people's expectations. People like myself, I think, bearish the dollar coming into this year, and have had to adjust as the dollar has basically been trending higher since like the 3rd or 4th of January.
Mark, where do you see the demand is coming from for the dollar? Because one thing that we've been hearing about recently, or really throughout this whole year, more focus has been on the bond market, and yields continue to rise. That means bonds continue to sell off. People were saying, oh, well, maybe this last little pullback in yields has been due to more of the foreign investors coming into the market, so then they need to buy dollars. But again, that's not looking at the whole picture of what's been happening this year. So where is the demand coming from for the dollar?
That's a good question. You know, it's one of the great things about the foreign exchange market, $6.6 trillion a day, daily, you know, average daily turnover. So we don't have a lot of transparency, but one place that does make it more transparent as far as participants is in the futures market. And as the year began, the speculators, sort of what the CFTC calls non-commercials, who don't have the underlying business need, were all short the U.S. dollar. And what we've been seeing in recent weeks, I'd say especially in the last 5 or 6 weeks, has been a big short covering. So that is, people were short the euro futures. They were long the futures. They've been liquidating those, in effect, then short the dollar. And I think that a good part of what we've been seeing is a short covering squeeze in the dollar. Now, we've reached, as I mentioned, we reached new highs for the year, but think about what happened before the year began. In November and December, the dollar sold off pretty hard. And we are just approaching those levels. For example, that would be 116 in the euro, translates to around 94.30 or so in the dollar index. I think the same thing can generally be true about many of the currencies, that even though they've weakened here, they're not, the dollar hasn't recouped everything it lost in November and December yet. And so I think those are the kind of levels that people are looking at.
So what are the levels that you're watching more closely in terms of maybe this run petering out or any strong resistance levels that you see simply on the dollar index?
Yeah, so on the dollar index, you know, I had this, I had thought that the dollar index had made a head and shoulders bottom by around the middle of January. And I thought that that projected up to about 92.75. Well, it's basically taken us 2 months to get there. And so, so sort of like now that we're there, what can we do? And I think that, you know, we pick these levels, not necessarily because they're the top, but because they're like reasonable to be achieved, like doable. And, you know, and so we stalled just in front of 93. We did get past that, my target. We got up a bit further yesterday, and that becomes the key level now, is about, we stopped just shy of 93. Now, I'm thinking we could go back up to that 94, 94.30 area if we can get above 93. We're consolidating today ahead of the weekend. It's not that big of a deal, and we're consolidating above the 200-day moving average. That comes in around 92.60. And this is the first time the dollar index has been above its 200-day moving average since last May. So here, I think we're like in the big picture, I think what's going on is this, I still want to see this as this uptick in the dollar index as largely corrective in nature. And, you know, we have to think about what does that mean? Well, think about what happened early last year when the pandemic first struck and how high the dollar index was. And that is to say, it was, I have it hitting about 102.99. on March 20th last year. And so if we're going to correct, so if the dollar sold off since then from that 102.99, we fell to 89.20 on January 6th. And so if we're going to correct, if that's the move that's behind us now, we're going to be correcting that. Where do we go? Well, the first retracement, that Fibonacci retracement, 38.2%, comes in there 94.50. So in a big, so if I'm right, this is corrective in nature, and the macro force behind this is divergence. The U.S. is on monetary policy, fiscal policy, the vaccine. The U.S. has been more aggressive than most of our trading partners, and more aggressive than most of the large, high-income countries. And so, so I think that this divergence lifts the dollar, but if not forever. It's not like this divergence is going to persist much longer. And by much longer, here's what I'm thinking. So Europe's a little bit slow on rolling out the vaccine, but starting next month, I expect to see it accelerated. They get a lot more deliveries of the vaccine. So I'm thinking, I had thought that late Q1, early Q2 was going to be the peak in divergence, but maybe it doesn't come till later in the quarter. At the same time, beginning probably in the summer, in the fall, we're going to begin talking about the fiscal cliff in the U.S. as some of the fiscal stimulus, the checks would have run out, some of the unemployment extensions would be expiring, other programs will be expiring. And so I'm thinking that the second half of the year will be more of a convergence over divergence. And by that time, I think they will see the dollar index rise a bit more. But for me, the longer-term view is still negative for the dollar. And it's because that the price, how we're getting to get this extra growth this year is through deficits, budget deficit, large one, but more, not just that budget deficit, because like who doesn't have a budget deficit, but the issue really is that by revving up the U.S. economy, the U.S. is going to be having reporting larger, perhaps close to the record level current account deficits. So I'm thinking in the second half of this year, so the dollar index has more room on the divergence momentum, carrying it further. But that by the second half of the year, we're going to begin talking about convergence, and we're going to begin talking about the twin deficit problem in the U.S. And so the longer the underlying bear market for the dollar can resume.
So longer term then, or even by the end of the year, mid this year maybe, you are still bearish on the dollar. We do need to understand big picture that volatility in the U.S. dollar to see in under a year it moved from 103 down to 89, and now it's bouncing. those are some historic moves when you take into account the dollar. So, again, last year was a just wild ride. When it comes to this generally higher dollar from at least the beginning of this year impacting other markets, what do you think its impact currently has been on commodities?
Yeah, you know, there's, in some ways, right, because most of these commodities are priced in dollars, you'd expect that a higher dollar dampens commodities. And maybe we're beginning to see some rolling over, some weakness, some of the industrial metals especially. Oil has been volatile. On the other hand, I wonder about the mechanics here. Of course, say iron ore that China buys from Australia or soybeans it buys from Brazil, they'd be invoiced in dollars. But the underlying demand is from China. And I think that's partly the story of commodities lately, is that it seems that the strength, when the dollar was falling in November and December, and even into January, people were talking about the super cycle in commodities. And now that the dollar has gained a little bit better traction, people are questioning that a bit. But at the same time, I think the story is really about China. As commodity prices were rallying, it looked like China was not only importing it to build goods, but also importing to rebuild inventories. And it's become clearer that the Biden administration is not going to backtrack anytime soon on these sanctions against China and these tariffs. So if you were sitting in Beijing, you'd have to be worried about this. And so the building up of the inventories, but now it seems in the last couple of weeks at least, that the inventory cycle, that the Chinese appetite for these metals for inventory purposes has dampened a bit. And so for me, I hear you that the dollar, the connection between the dollar and commodity prices, it's sort of mechanical because the invoice in dollars. But at the same time, don't lose sight of the demand side coming from China, especially as the factory of the world.
Yeah, fair enough. China is a major player in commodities. We've seen that over the last at least few decades here. Any other markets that you think this rise in the dollar is impacting then?
Well, I think that in some ways, if you tell me the dollar is going up, you know, there's what do people want to do? It's interesting that, you know, for good fundamental reasons, the U.S. equity market typically outperforms Europe. We have faster growing, more profitable businesses, all kinds of good reasons. And the U.S. stock market so far this year, looking at, say, the S&P 500, is up about 5%. Most of the major European bourses are up more than that. And so I wonder if the strong dollar, what do people want to do? You buy European exporters who benefit. You buy the exporters because they benefit from a weaker euro, and as a way to move out of a highly overvalued or a very rich market like the U.S. and buying some of the underperformers in Europe. At the same time, you know, our indexes in the U.S. are so heavily weighted to technology. Europe's not. And so I think that also helps explain why the Chinese stock market is really the worst performing major market this year, because it's so heavily weighted towards technology. Europe is not so weighted towards technology. I would say in Europe's case, big difference, heavier weighting for banks and heavier weighting for oil. And so with both of those markets having been in doing well, say, it's not that surprising that like the DAX is up, the French stock market is almost up 8%. So we are seeing, I think, some rotation. And if it's sort of like one of these recurring fancies that people get, and maybe this is another window of them, and that is that Europe can outperform the U.S. in the stock market.
That would be interesting. Now, let's wrap it up here quickly, Mark, with just a quick comment on what you're watching for next week. Next week is going to be a shortened trading week thanks to Easter, but there are some big events that should be noted. Please share with us which ones you're watching.
So I think for a lot of people, next Wednesday, when President Biden is in Pittsburgh, he's going to choose that heartland of America to unveil his infrastructure program. It looks like about $3 trillion. I would imagine it would come in two parts. One is for the material infrastructure, the energy networks, highways, roads, bridges. And then there's going to be a human capital part of it. And that human capital part will be medical, and it'll also be education. And so that's, I mean, after this $1.9 trillion fiscal stimulus package, everybody's known that the infrastructure bill's coming. It's taken shape over the last few weeks, and it'll be announced next Wednesday. And that will be followed 48 hours later or so by the U.S. jobs data. I know it's Good Friday. The Bureau of Labor Statistics doesn't care that much, and they're still going to release the jobs data. And it should be a very strong report. Remember, February was held back by some bad weather, and we're seeing like much stronger weekly initial jobless, as much weaker, I should say, larger drawdowns, weekly initial jobless claims. So a lot of things pointing to a very strong non-farm payroll number, and by very strong, to have to put a number on it, upwards of 600,000, maybe 650,000 or so. So that's probably the single biggest release next week. The Eurozone reports CPI, but even if it's a bit firmer than expected, doesn't really matter because ECB President Lagarde says she's going to see through that. China reports their PMI, and you know this is kind of a typical seasonal story. Lunar New Year holiday in February depresses the numbers, and March it bounces back. So that might fit in a bit with the commodity story for you as well. And the other thing that happens next week is the Japanese report their Tankan survey. It's a bit like the PMI survey, giving you a sense of the manufacturing and non-manufacturing parts of the economy. The Japanese economy, the world's third largest, looks like it's contracting this quarter. Partly it's still the pandemic as the main headwind to it, but it's looking better. Some of our leading indicators looking better for Q2 for Japan. But next week, highlight for them is the Tankan survey.
Okay. Hey, Mark, great chatting with you. Thank you for wrapping up this weekend show. Everybody, thank you for tuning in. And again, please go back through our website, kereport.com. Listen to all those daily editorials and all those company updates and introductions I recorded this week. I value all of your opinions. So please keep those emails coming to fleck@kereport.com. Let me know what you think of the companies and any other topics that you want me to discuss and focus on in the upcoming weeks. Mark, everyone else, I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you. Good luck to everybody.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.